This is Positive Parenting. Parenting expertise and advice from best-selling parenting author and national newspaper columnist, Mr. Dad, Armin Brott.
Hello and welcome to today's Positive Parenting Show. I'm Armin Brott. Bullying has emerged as one of the biggest problems facing our schools, but it's largely due to increased awareness and sensitivity about the consequences of being victimized. The media has actually done a pretty good job of creating a sense of urgency about bullying, and parents are desperate to protect their children, and of course, who wouldn't be? We're closely tracking bullying, and we're taking steps to try to reduce these aggressive acts, and we're counting the victims. A 2010 study that was done by the National Center for Education and Statistics found that 32% of students between the ages of 12 and 18 had reported being bullied within the 6 months just before they were surveyed. Of those students, 62% reported having been bullied once or twice a year, 21% said it was once or twice a month, 10% once or twice a week, and 7% said every single day. 2009, there was a National Youth Risk Behavior Study and found that 1 in 5 teens had been bullied at school in the last year, and nearly half of middle school kids had been bullied. In today's show, we're going to be talking about bullying. Who are the bullies? Who are the victims? Why do bullies do what they do? What can parents and educators do to keep kids safe? And why those zero tolerance for bullying policies at school may actually backfire? I'm Armin Brott. All that and a lot more is coming up in today's Positive Parenting Show after this.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this. From the MrDad.com radio network.
Excuse me, do you know how to get to Maine and Maple?
Do you have these in a 7.5?
How's that cooked?
Can I get that shipped overnight?
Is there a direct flight?
How long does the warranty last?
What's your soup of the day?
How do you change the ringtone?
Does it come in blue?
Does this bus stop at Elm Street?
We ask questions everywhere in life.
Is it raining out?
What time's the meeting?
How much does this cost?
Does it have four-wheel drive?
Have we met before?
What's my account balance?
Yet somehow, when we get to the doctor's office...
Any questions?
No.
We clam up. Ask questions.
What is this test for?
Are there any side effects?
When do I get my results?
Questions lead to better health care. Go to ahrq.gov for a list of 10 questions everyone should know. Questions are the answer. Public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of
Welcome
Health
back
and
to
Human
Positive
Services
Parenting.
And the
Ad Council. And my guest for this part of today's show is Carrie Goldman, who's the author of Bullied, What Every Parent, Teacher, and Kid Needs to Know About Ending the Cycle of Fear. Carrie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You know, let's start off with the story of how you kind of got into this, which was triggered in a way by an incident that happened with your own daughter. Tell us that story a little bit.
Sure. It was a very unexpected story. In November of 2010, my daughter, Katie, who was then in first grade and was a very rabid Star Wars fan, one day decided she wanted to stop carrying her favorite Star Wars water bottle. And normally, I don't push things right away, but it just seemed odd to me. And so, I kind of questioned her about it, and she started to cry and told me that the boys in the first grade were following her around on the playground and at lunch, telling her that Star Wars was for boys and not for girls, and taunting her. So I wrote a post about it. I have a blog called Portrait of an Adoption, and I wasn't expecting much of a response beyond the usual couple comments, but it really hit a nerve, and it went viral. I call it the post that launched 1,000 geeks. And pretty soon I had responses coming in from all over the world, stories of people who had been taunted or bullied and, offering their support. And so I decided to start researching bullying and learn more about it because the response had been so great that it made me think there's something bigger going on here than just a little girl being taunted about a water bottle. This is just such a major issue in our culture. So I started working on the book.
It strikes me, though, for first graders, they're so rigid in their rules that they have for gender behavior and things like that. How could you separate out the natural first grade boys do this and girls do that behavior from bullying?
That is such a great question. And there is no doubt that for a number of the boys who are part of this, they were simply reflecting what they have learned as Katie was sort of violating a social norm. These are kids who, they go into a Target or a Walmart, and they see the Star Wars toys and clothes in a very clearly labeled boys section. And at this point in their lives, kids are very literal. And so when they saw Katie with her Star Wars backpack and Star Wars water bottle, some of them were literally trying to make sense of it, saying, wait a minute, this is for boys, not for girls. And then there's another group that would join in, and that's sort of when you have bystanders who just want to pile on someone and give them a hard time, and that's when more of the sneers come. There's a group that says, hey, you can't do that, that's for boys, and then there's a group that's like a different tone of voice, more mm-hmm. cruelty, and that's when you switch from simply observing a behavior to taunting and teasing.
Okay, now that makes sense. So let's talk about some of the boy-girl stuff, because it's
sure.
not only boys who are picking on girls.
Oh, not at all.
It goes the other way as well. Boys who are somewhat less sports interested, or they may have this kind of the stereotypical tape on the glasses, or just be a
right.
little bit nerdy. They take a lot of crap too.
They take more, actually. I do believe that more androgyny is acceptable for girls than for boys. And if, for example, I had a son who was being taunted for carrying a princess water bottle, and I'd written this post, I'm sure there would not have been quite as wide a base of support for that type of story. So it is true that boys who vary from their gender norm have an even harder time than Katie did. It's not so much the children. The children universally will say to someone, hey, this is for boys, this is for girls. But when you look at it from the point of view of the adults, in the adult world, there's more tolerance for a girl who, pursues a typically boy interest than a boy who pursues a less masculine interest.
Yeah, I get questions like that all the time. People who say, my son likes to wear barrettes in his hair or something, and I'm afraid he's going to be a cross-dresser for life. I mean,
exactly.
you wouldn't say that about a girl who decides she's going to wear boots and overalls or something.
No, you wouldn't. And, there's a whole other layer of fear of homosexuality that's involved in that. And, talk of whether the way you parent a child affects the way a child turns out. In a lot of the research that has been done, it has shown that kids pretty much are who they are. And what you do as a parent, whether you tell them yes or no to carrying Star Wars or princesses or this or that, doesn't affect their core being, and that it's actually easier for them if you just support who they are. But for a lot of parents, it's very difficult because they reach the condemnation of society, and it's really, really hard to know what's best. I mean, we all want to do what's best for our kids, and we know that what's best for our kids is not being bullied. So we have a group of parents who say, I'm protecting my child from being bullied by not letting him or her do things that are gender inappropriate. And the response that I'm hearing to that from a number of psychologists is that in that case, without knowing it, parents are often protecting the stereotype but not protecting the child.
Interesting.
And that's a very new thought for a lot of people.
You know, what else is kind of new, I'm sure that you came across this in the rather extensive research that you did for this book, was that the thinking about, even within the psychological community, thinking about what's driving bullies changes
mm-hmm.
from time to time. And I remember a couple of years ago, it used to be, well, bullies have low self-esteem, and then we should be comforting them, and they need help. And then it became, a couple of years ago, it was, well, bullies are just kind of nasty people. And it's changing a little bit now. Where do you see things what drives bullies?
I think that what drives bullies is changing, partly in due to some of the cultural changes, like reality TV. There have been studies done that show that kids who watch reality TV believe that there is more bullying necessary to achieve your goals in life. So they see people being mean to each other or being nasty to each other in order to win or to get ahead, and then they mimic that behavior. And that is a change from the old-fashioned view that bullies are just very insecure. We have a fundamental shift here where bullies are saying, no, I'm going to be mean to get what I want.
So you think it's becoming a deliberate thing?
It's becoming more deliberate. Huh. And the other thing is that in schools, studies have shown that the kids who are most likely to be the bullies, it's not the kids at the bottom of the social rung who are the most insecure. And it's not even the kids at the very, very top of the social rung who are the most popular. It's the kids one notch down from the top of the rung who believe they have the most to gain. They tend to be cruel and try and outdo other kids in order to move up to the top notch. And so, you know, there are kids who often have a pretty strong social profile to begin with.
You know, that has really, really bothered me, I got to say, that things like America's Next Top Model and all those kinds of shows, it's not just the contestants,
right,
it's everybody else.
Absolutely. The Girl Scouts conducted some research, and they found that of girls ages 11 to 17 who regularly watch reality show, they expect and engage in more bullying in their own lives, but they also are more likely than non-viewers to believe that your appearance is what your value is based on. They are more likely to think that telling lies is okay to get what you want,
mm-hmm,
and they're more likely to believe that gossip and cruelty is a legitimate way to achieve a goal. And so, you know, these are very serious side effects of the reality TV shows like, you know, Jersey Shore and Bachelorette and all of these types of shows.
Talk a little bit about, for just a minute, about the harmful effects of bullying on the brain.
Okay, sure. Bullying affects the brain more than we've ever known before. There have been studies that show that the brain reacts to social pain with some of the same responses as it reacts to physical pain. The brain of a child as young as 13 has been shown to light up in areas of physical pain in response to bullying and ostracism. So what happens is, as a child is bullied and a child, you know, receives this painful experience, they become more sensitive. And over time, it's almost like a post-traumatic stress disorder response. Over time, the brain changes so that even encounters that are aggressive but not truly bullying tend to create the same response, the same panic, the same anxiety, the same depression. And so it changes, and a child becomes less resilient.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Carrie Goldman, who's the author of Bullied, What Every Parent, Teacher, and Kid Needs to Know About Ending the Cycle of Fear. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue talking with Carrie. I want to get into some of the where do we go from here things about how we deal with these and how we can prevent it and help our kids cope. I'm Armin Brott. You're listening to Positive Parenting.
Bullying is not kids being kids.
It's not about good homes or bad homes.
It's not a normal part of growing up.
I shouldn't be afraid to get on the school bus,
to turn on my computer,
message, or walk to my locker.
Did you know that a bully will stop his or her behavior in 10 seconds when their peers speak up?
Use your voice.
Hey, leave him alone.
We have the power to stop bullying.
Find out more at bullying.org.
Where you're not alone.
You must be your fairy godmother. Yes.
It doesn't take a fairy godmother to tell you that the right fit means everything.
Good heavens, child. You can't go in that.
Children under 4'9" need to be in a booster seat because they aren't ready for adult safety belts alone. Many parents miss the important step of booster seats.
Maybe you better explain things to him.
Booster seats raise your child up so that a safety belt designed for adults will fit and protect them properly.
Oh, that does make a difference.
Remember that 4'9" is the magic number, and get your little pumpkin there safely in a booster seat.
Hop in, my dear. Oh, thank you.
And like Cinderella, you can live happily ever after.
It's like a dream. A wonderful dream come true.
For more information, visit boosterseat.gov. This has been a message from the U.S. Department of Transportation and the Ad Council.
Looking for the best all-you-can-eat buffet for only $1.99? Come to Big Ed's Chow House. But if you're looking for Big Ed, don't come to Big Ed's Chow House. Big Ed passed away last week at 47, leaving his wife and children struck down in his prime by the same disease that got his father, so he won't be around for his family. And sadly, it could have been detected early with a simple test, but Big Ed didn't get it.
Have you gotten the medical test you need? For a list of tests every man should have, go to AHRQ.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Broad. If you're just joining us, we've been talking with Kerry Goldman, who's the author of Bullied, What Every Parent, Teacher, and Kid Needs to Know About Ending the Cycle of Fear. And I'd like to jump in, as kind of promised before the break, to part three of the book, which talks about prevention, intervention, and reconciliation. So what do you do at home to help your child who comes home, who hopefully will tell you about it? I mean, hopefully you'll have the same, or everybody else have the same sort of experience you did of being able to push a little bit and find out that something is going on.
Sure. Well, what you do at home changes depending on whether you're hearing the message that your child is the victim or the bully. And actually, in the book, I did have a whole chapter called Responding to the Bully. But for this sake, we'll assume that your child is being victimized. And the number one thing you need to do is just don't dismiss it. Don't say things like, oh, that's part of childhood, or, you know, kids will be kids, or these things are, you know, it's a rite of passage. Bullying is not a rite of passage. It is not a regular part of childhood. It's an antisocial behavior, and the children who are bullied really do suffer very real effects from it. So the first thing you want to do is, you know, tell your child, I hear you, I see this is a problem. And then you want to say to them that you're going to do something to help, that you're going to take steps with them, but you want to involve them, even with the youngest child. You don't want to say, I'm going to storm in and talk to the school and make this stop, because you want your child to feel a little empowered as part of the solution. It's great if you can sit down and get a record of it together. One of the very first things I did with my daughter was write down the story that she was telling me of what was happening. You and your kid, you sit down and you write down what's happening and you make a record of it, and then you take it to the teacher. And if the teacher is dismissive, you take it to the principal. And if the principal's dismissive, you take it to the school board. Everyone answers to someone, and every child has a right to be safe at school. So, and it's very hard to argue with a written factual account of something that's happened to your child. If it's cyberbullying, mm-hmm. Take a screenshot. You know, take a screenshot of the Facebook page so that you have some unemotional evidence with you that you can back up your claim of what's happening.
Do you hope or do you expect that parents are going to talk directly to the parents of the other child, or do you not do that at all?
Well, it depends on the age of the children, how you handle it. You know, if you're in a situation with a very serious bullying situation, chances are that the parents of the other child are going to be dismissive. They either already know that their child has some problems and they're used to shrugging it off, and a lot of bullies learn their behavior at home. So, you know, don't be surprised if you knock on the door or call and the other parent says, you know, something to the effects of, oh, he was just joking around, or, oh, it was just a harmless prank. You're going to run into that because, you know, bullies learn it somewhere. So it's really best to take it to someone who is in a position to respond. I mean, it's great to give a heads up to the other parent if you can. And if they're willing to work with you, that is wonderful. You could, with the younger children, you know, you can try and set up a structured play date for a chance for the kids to get to know each other. Maybe the bully can build some empathy. One of the things that research has shown is that the zero tolerance policies that schools mm-hmm. were using are not very effective. You know, it creates a chilling effect because if a child knows that he's going to report bullying and the bully is going to be expelled or suspended, the child's going to be afraid to report it because they're going to be afraid of retaliation.
Sure.
So what's happening is schools were saying, okay, we have a zero tolerance policy, but all it did was just push the victims further into the fear and silence and suffering. So newer research shows what's very promising is taking steps like restorative justice. Restorative justice is a way for the victim and the bully to be put into a situation where the bully actually has to try and restore the harm that's been done and view the victim as a real person instead of just an other.
Can you give me an example of that?
Sure. let me give you two, one for a younger child and one for an older child. For a younger child, let's say that a kid, let's say kid A took kid B's lunch and smashed his new Superman lunchbox and, you know, was taunting him in the school in ways like that. Restorative justice would work where the kid who's the offender would have to find a way to repair the harm that's been done. And he, one idea that he could come up with, and usually you want the child who did the bullying to be the one to come up with the solution, although you can kind of guide them and help them, but you want them to be the one thinking of it. But one way that it could work is he could find out what the victim's favorite foods were, and he could make him a lunch for the next day. He could use some money from his allowance and buy the victim a new Star Wars or Superman lunchbox or whatever it was he destroyed. He could take steps to right the wrong he did.
Well, who directs that, though, Carrie?
Who would direct it?
Yeah, well, I mean, who's going to be the one who's enforcing it?
Well, a social worker can do it. A lot of schools, public schools now, can work with local police stations to have a restorative justice departments from the juvenile offender area actually come into the school and orchestrate it. And with older kids, an example that you might use, and again, you can use social workers, you can use teachers, you can use the police if it's a more serious situation. Let's take a cyberbullying case. If you're a girl who has sent a vicious or cruel rumor, a text to other people about someone, and you know it gets caught and reported, and they want to try restorative justice. If you're the girl who was the perpetrator, you could first take steps to right the wrong. You send another text to all your contacts, and you simply say, I sent this, it wasn't true, please don't keep forwarding it. You know, it was a lie and a rumor. So let's say you want to take further steps to repair the harm you've done. You go to the girl who was the object of the rumors, and now that girl's being ostracized and, you know, been just totally left out at lunch from everyone because everyone's talking about the rumor. You invite her to your table. You say, you come sit with me at lunch. You know, I did this to you. I'm gonna reach out that hand of friendship, and I'm going to sit with you.
Does that really work? I can't imagine a situation where that could possibly happen.
It doesn't happen without a careful, guided process first of the restorative process. It's where you build understanding and empathy. So you have this thing called like a circle, a restorative justice circle. The victim is invited, and the victim brings a witness, and the perpetrator is invited, and the perpetrator brings a witness, and then there's someone who oversees it, you know, either a social worker or someone who's trained in restorative justice. And you have this very confidential circle where you first take turns and you talk about how you were impacted by what happened, who you are, what you like and dislike. You kind of reveal more about yourself in this very private, confidential setting. And after doing a process like that, it's in that circle that you then, together with your supportive witness, come up with the solution. So it's not like someone hands it down to you and says, you have to do this. You have to take these steps. Because otherwise it won't work, like you said. Whose heart would be in it? But if you have a Sunday afternoon, where you've spent a couple hours sitting with, you know, the victim and the bully and the parents and a neutral person who's skilled at overseeing the circle, and you have this outpouring of who you are, it does work. And in fact, it works so well that they use it in the criminal courts. That's where it first arose.
So, Carrie, we only have just about a minute left, but I do want to have you talk a little bit about the idea of teaching kids to retaliate on their own. Do you teach a child to hit back if that's what's necessary?
In my book, I have a section where I provide some very guided defensive stances you can take if you are in the situation where you're physically being bullied and there's nothing you can do to get out of it at that moment. I certainly would never advocate that a child hit back, but if you're being struck and you need to block or defend, there are guidelines for how to block and defend and protect yourself from serious harm as much as you can. But what parents need to know is that no matter what, if your child's engaged in something that looks like a fight, you can expect a serious consequence, even if your child didn't start it, even if they're just protecting themselves, because most schools have no tolerance for fighting. But if I were a parent whose child was at risk of being attacked and jumped, I would want my child to have a few, you know, stances and poses. And there's actually ways you can practice mm-hmm. with your child to help him or her learn how to protect himself. And I highly recommend for those kids to take, you know, martial arts classes.
Carrie Goldman's the author of Bullied, What Every Parent, Teacher, and Kid Needs to Know About Ending the Cycle of Fear. Carrie, thanks for joining us. Great to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, Dad.
What?
I can't get the ketchup bottle open.
Here, let me try. Yeah, it's stuck all right.
Anything?
Now watch. If you take your palm like this and smack it on the bottom right here, you can get it open pretty easily. Here you go.
Thanks.
You don't have to be a hero to be a hero. When you adopt a child from foster care, just being there makes all the difference. To find out how you can adopt, please visit our website at AdoptUSKids.org or call 1-888-200-4005. A public service announcement brought to you by AdoptUSKids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
In our last segment today, I want to spend a few minutes talking about something that's becoming more and more common as more and more families are blended, and that is disciplining stepkids. And here's a letter that came in that captures the idea perfectly. Dear Mr. Dad, this is my second marriage, and I'm totally committed to my new wife. But even though I hate to admit it, her two kids from her previous marriage are driving me crazy. They play one of us against the other, and my wife, being their mom, usually takes their side in any disagreement. How can we keep our marriage stable and still come to some agreement on disciplining the kids? For some couples, second marriages are a breeze. But most experience all sorts of problems in merging two different households with different traditions and different ways of life. And it's often a lot harder on the kids than it is on the adults. At least the adults have some control over the situation. Kids have practically none. Some children resent their parents' remarriages, while others may feel bewildered by new expectations, and they react just like anyone else does who has to cope with an uncertain and frightening situation. They do whatever they can to regain some control. Sometimes this plays out as deliberately pushing their parents or their step-parents' buttons, or, as you've seen quite often, pitting the two of you off each other. None of this, however, relieves them of the obligation to respect the new step-parent. The place to start is with a behind-closed-doors meeting with your wife. Talk about your expectations and hers. What kind of behavior is acceptable? What kind of behavior isn't acceptable for either one of you? Because she's the biological parent, it's important that you come up with a plan that she can and will enforce. The kids are less likely to resent taking direction and discipline from mom than they are from you. Several important things to keep in mind, though. First, biological parents tend to under-discipline their kids, especially in the eyes of the step-parents, and that's often the result of a perfectly well-intentioned desire to reduce the stress in the kids' lives. After all, they've been through enough already, haven't they? Second, at some point, you're going to have to step in. It's tempting to try to leave everything up to the biological parent, but that's not an effective long-term solution. Next, keep your expectations reasonable. Creating a well-oiled family machine will not happen overnight, if it does at all. Some experts say that it can take as long for a new family to gel as the age of the children when you get involved with each other. Finally, know your place. You want the kids to like and respect you, but you're not their father. So set your sights on building a solid relationship that's completely independent of their mother. The stronger that relationship is, the more likely the kids are going to be to take direction from you. To the extent possible, you and your wife should try to present a united front and to make sure that everyone knows what happens if they either follow the rules or don't follow the rules. The trick is going to be to come up with fair and reasonable consequences that won't overwhelm the kids completely. Timeouts, loss of privileges, and extra housework are pretty typical responses to noncompliance in a lot of families. If you and your wife can't agree on household rules or discipline, this may be a good time to discuss the situation with a trained counselor who can offer an objective perspective, at least. It may take just a few sessions to work through your differences and come to an agreement on what the kids should and shouldn't do. But be prepared to compromise. A lot. When, not if, you and your wife disagree, be sure to listen to each other respectfully. The kids will eventually grow up and leave home. Hopefully, your marriage will last long after they've gone.
Thanks for listening to Positive Parenting. You can get more information on today's show and what we're working on in the weeks ahead at MrDad.com. While you're there, visit the MrDad.com gift shop with everything you need to help you become the dad or mom you want to be. Positive Parenting is a production of the MrDad.com radio network. Now, go be a great parent.